we're talking about the 2020 census on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The count has been disrupted by the pandemic, and it's slated to be wrapped up by the end of next month, raising concerns that it could be rushed. Meanwhile, Wisconsin's response rate is number two in the nation behind our neighbor Minnesota. According to the 2020 census, as of midweek, Wisconsin's self-response rate is nearly 70%. The national average is about 64%. Minnesota leads the nation at nearly 73% of households responding to the survey online, by mail, or by phone. What do you want to know about the census and its timeline? We're at 800-642-1234. Marilyn Sanders is the Chicago Regional Director of the U.S. Census Bureau, and her service area includes Wisconsin and seven other neighboring states. Marilyn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, taking
glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Looking at the response data tracker for your region, it seems the Midwest is tracking returns pretty much on par with 2010, maybe a little behind. What are you reading? What are you seeing?
Yes, we are leading the country in the Midwest, but we do have a few areas that are trending a little bit behind 2010. It's important to note that this census has the opportunity to do online responses for the first time and also the call in on the telephone. And of course, the event of COVID-19, we retooled and rescheduled some of our operations. But yes, we are doing pretty well in the state of Wisconsin.
Why does Wisconsin usually have a pretty high response rate?
So I think it's in part because of the support that we have received in, and it has been tremendous from the state, local level, from the governor's office to all of the county level major cities. About 2.5 years ago, we started to do our education and outreach campaign to make people aware that the census was coming in 2020, how important it was, and what it meant to each community.
Why are some households, some people, harder to count?
So historically, there are areas that are difficult to count, and primarily it is where there is fear of the government, not really understanding the importance of the questions that we ask. And then, of course, you have the senior population, those that are not comfortable with providing information or providing data. And then it's an education component that must be continually voiced through trusted voices. So it's a combination of not knowing the importance, what it is, and of course, just fear of providing information to the federal government.
And you've started sending people door-to-door to follow up on census forms that haven't been returned. How is that going?
So we're just getting started. The national kickoff for knocking on doors was August 9th, and we're doing pretty well. Of course, this operation will go through September the 30th. So we want to make certain that everyone knows that we are knocking on doors to collect information from those households who have not responded, that our employees are prepared with PPE, should be wearing a mask at all times, should safely interview the households. All of them should have a photo ID, and that's important for everyone to know.
All right, and so when someone comes to the door, knocks on the door, what is the protocol for making sure to keep a safe social distance? How do you do that interview?
So it is important that they keep their mask on at all times, and they have to maintain social distance, and they will provide masks to the respondent as well if they would like to have one. So it's about a 10-minute interview. And it only takes 10 minutes, so it's important also to note that they will leave a notice of visit to let the household know that they have visited if they're not home. And even as we're knocking on doors, you can still go online. You can still go to 2020census.gov and complete the census, and that's important to note. And if necessary, you can also complete the census by phone by calling 844-330-2020. That's 844-330-2020.
And we'll have those resources as well at WPR.org/mornings. We're talking with Marilyn Sanders of the U.S. Census Bureau. The census is wrapping up its decennial count by the end of September. You can join in with your questions. Have you returned your census form yet? Do you know where it is? Are you concerned people in your community won't be counted? Do you have concerns about what the census asks? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Marilyn, can you give us a timeline here about what happens next in the census and how this process unfolds?
So the data collection process ends in September, and then from there we begin the processing of the data. Now, it's also important to note that we do quality control, so we do some follow-up, and that is to make certain that we have the most accurate and complete data. So quality control will last a little bit beyond that time. We also conduct a post-enumeration survey. And the post-enumeration survey is a survey that we utilize in order to measure the quality in terms of the overcount or undercount for the census. And then we begin the tabulation and the data collection. We also have operations that will be going on and are currently going on that's important to getting a complete count. And that is what we call our group quarters enumeration. So in addition to knocking on doors, we're also visiting those facilities that operate, such as nursing homes, if they're available for us to go and conduct. And what we do in nursing homes, which is important to note, we actually lead the questionnaires and work with the administrators in order for them to help us facilitate getting a response. We also have to do what we call transitory locations. And in Wisconsin, you have vacation areas, you have mobile home parks, you have transitory type locations. So that will be ongoing during the month of September as well. But most importantly, data collection ends on September 30th, and you can still respond online until that time. But then we start the process of completing the quality control and tabulating the data that we've collected.
What happens if you can't get into a group quarters like a nursing home?
So what's been important this census is our ability to allow the nursing facilities also to do what we call e-response. And so that operation is going on. They can still go and provide the information online. So some of the follow-up we're doing is to also make certain that they're aware that they can do it online. So it's a continuing process that we've been doing now with the online responses and reaching out to those facilities. We've been doing that all along. So now we're going to safely deploy people to go to those facilities, see if they're still open, see if they have completed the online responses. They also had the opportunity to provide us a mail back response where they would complete the information, we would pick it up, and then we would process it. So there's been several opportunities provided, and we'll continue to do that all the way up to September 30th.
Marilyn Sanders is Chicago Regional Director for the U.S. Census Bureau, talking about the status of data collection as the count wraps up September 30th. Have you returned your form yet? What do you want to know about the census? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Marilyn Sanders on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on the 2020 census on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Census workers started knocking on doors earlier this week. All offices are scheduled to complete their work by September 30th. Census data is collected every 10 years, and hundreds of federal spending programs rely on data from the count to guide the distribution of federal tax dollars. What do you want to know about the work of the census in Wisconsin? It's 800-642-1234. Marilyn Sanders is the Chicago Regional Director of the U.S. Census Bureau, and she started as a field representative in the mid-70s, and she stays with us. So, Marilyn, you know, starting in the mid-70s, how have you seen the census evolve over the decades through the digital age, through the dawn of the internet and the web, now a pandemic?
So, yes, it's really been a wonderful, awesome experience. So there was times when we did not, of course, have internet or have the ability to go online. So we had to manage a lot of paper. Our offices was much larger, and I think the most important point was trying to track and keep up with all of the paper. Technology has afforded us the opportunity, this census, that even in the midst of a pandemic, you were still able in the privacy of your home to go online and complete the census. We had telephone assistance in previous censuses, but not the ability for you to complete the census by calling in on the telephone. So those are major changes. I think over time, historically, though, it's always been the same in terms of needing to educate and needing to get trusted voices in the communities that understand all the billions of dollars that are distributed annually based on census numbers. And the fact that for the next 10 years, this data will inform decisions that are made for future generations on schools, where to put daycares, where we may need hospitals, emergency services. So that has continued to be a message that we needed to get out down through the years. However, the technology, the way we're able to collect data, that has changed tremendously.
Do you think people understand the consequences of these counts?
So I think it's something that requires a lot of reminders. And I think that the federal government does invest in a partnership, an outreach program. We have marketing, there are commercials on now, and we've changed those commercials based on COVID-19. We're doing more radio. But I think at the end of the day, it is important when individuals understand the resources that their community, their state, their local government, federal funding that they miss out on when one person is not counted. And you miss those funds for the next 10 years. Public work programs, I think, is so much that we can make people aware of that many are not on how the census informs the funding that comes back to the community for business and all those things that are needful for a community to thrive, public safety, emergency preparedness, even in the midst of COVID-19, knowing how many people lived in a community. That information was so critical. And we only get this chance every 10 years to participate in the census.
We're talking with Marilyn Sanders of the U.S. Census Bureau. The census is wrapping up its count by the end of September. Taking your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Ray now, who's joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Yes, good morning. I consider myself to be on the left, actually the far left, but the question I have today is, I know what the Constitution says, to count every person. But since the census is used to politically divide our country, how many states get how many senators, etc., how is it fair to citizens to use non-citizens in that count that divvy up a representative? It doesn't seem fair to me. Shouldn't there be two censuses? One which asks the constitutional question, count every person, and then a second one that says count everybody who can legally vote because it doesn't seem fair.
Ray, let's get Marilyn's response on that in terms of how the census is counted in terms of people who are legal citizens and who may be immigrants to the country. Marilyn?
So since 1790, we have conducted the census, and our mandate through the Constitution is to count everyone. And our goal is to count everyone once and only once and in the right place. Our mission is to do the count, and that's what we are conducting. So it is important to note that the Census Bureau follows and is following our constitutional mandate, which is to take the census, a count of every person living in the U.S. once, only once, and in the right place.
What happens for a state that has a low census return? I was looking at the response data from other states and, you know, for instance, in a state I used to live in, Louisiana has a very low response rate right now, Mississippi low. What about those states?
So what you're looking at is a self-response rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so self-response rates represent where individuals have gone online, mailed back the questionnaire, or called in on the telephone. So what we're doing in low response rate areas right now, of course, we're knocking on doors. But in addition to that, we have a mobile questionnaire assistance program that we have put in place. And in past censuses, we had what you call questionnaire assistance centers. This census, we have mobile questionnaire assistance. So we have trained what we call census representatives, to go to places where individuals are going for essential services, where they may be distributing food, water, things of that nature. And we have them deployed throughout the country. And they're going to these events, helping people to navigate the instrument, letting them know how to get to 2020census.gov. We're also doing virtual workshops, virtual meetings. We're doing virtual events through social media in those communities that are low responding. I mentioned our outreach program and the fact that we have partnership specialists throughout the country, and they're responsible for working at that lowest level within that community, finding that trusted voice at the community center, engaging them to help them to conduct a virtual Zoom meeting to get people engaged. We're also asking our Complete Count committees to do things such as parades through their community where they can display census messages and make certain that we get the word out that way. So in low-performing areas, we are hiring additional staff to go to events where people are going currently for social essential services. So there are a lot of people that still go to the grocery stores, go to Walmart. There are events that cities are having to support individuals that are in need. And so we are deploying staff there with census materials to help people understand the importance. And then, of course, we're knocking on doors, and we will continue to knock on those doors to get a response.
Marilyn, do you think you can get this data collection done by September 30th?
Yes, we have continuing to hire, and I want to point that out, we're still hiring. And if you're interested in working for us, and the average pay rate is about $29 an hour across the country, different pay rates by county and state, but that's the average. We're also offering an award. You can earn up to $800 in addition to your salary based on the number of hours that you work. So it's important also for us to let individuals know that you can still work for us. The census still has an online application process, and the sooner you go through that process, because everyone has to go through a fingerprinting and a background clearance. But we're still hiring, and we'll continue to hire people and train people and get people to help us with this most important mission, and that is to get everyone counted. and get them counted by September the 30th.
Have the recent derecho storms and tornadoes set back your efforts at all?
So, of course, you have what we call no-show rates. We may invite, and we do these trainings by bringing individuals on, and this is important, social distancing, providing them their onboarding documents where they sign all of their documents. They are given their equipment, and then they are tasked with going home and completing their training online. Once they complete that training online, they do a final assessment, and then we release to them work for them to do. It's important, though, that they identify the hours that they are available to work. This census, you talked about how things have changed. In past censuses, we assigned everybody the work, and we kind of hoped everybody went out and completed the work. This census, we have the opportunity to efficiently assign work. And so each individual, based on the hours that they're available to work for us, will get an assignment.
Marilyn, thank you so much for joining. Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Marilyn Sanders, Chicago Regional Director of the U.S. Census Bureau. For disclosure, the U.S. Census Bureau is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. News is next on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what changes the COVID-19 pandemic will bring to sports and the decisions coming down. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NBA has its Disney World bubble with playoffs starting Monday. NFL training camps are underway, and the league announced midweek that less than 1% of tests have come back positive. The NFL's chief medical officer reported the data on a conference call with reporters. Daily testing will go on until further notice. That's from NFL.com. If you were a pro athlete, how often would you want to be tested for the coronavirus? What would you want to have happen if a player or coach tests positive? It's 800-642-1234. Olivia Reiner is a sports multimedia reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers Packers, Brewers, and Bucks. Olivia, welcome back to the Ideas Network. Hey, Olivia, can you hear us? I don't seem to be hearing Olivia, but we are talking sports with her. She was there just a moment ago. We're looking at how the sports world has been changing amid the pandemic, everything from the NBA to the NFL to the Big Ten announcing that this week that they would postpone the fall sports season. What does that mean for how you will consume sports? Are you a Bucks, Brewers, or Packers fan? How do you feel after the league suspended their seasons? Which sports do you usually enjoy watching this time of year? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We're going to be looking at the consequences of the sports world amid the pandemic and what it means for fall with Olivia Reiner. Olivia, can you hear me now? It seems like we're still not able to get Olivia Reiner. Olivia, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh,
hello.
Good. Hi. So let's start with the Big Ten, which announced this week that, you know, there wouldn't be fall sports. What does that mean? Did the earth move?
It certainly seems like it might, right? Yeah, there's still so many questions about what is going to happen to the fall football season. At the moment, the Big Ten, as well as the Pac-12, they're both saying right now that fall sports are off, football season is off, and it's being delayed to the spring. The aspiration is that they're going to play a season in the spring. So they're hoping at that point that the coronavirus spread has gone down, perhaps that there's some sort of vaccine out there in the world. However, that also presents the challenge of playing two seasons in one year. So they'd be playing both in the spring and then starting the following season on time in the fall, which presents issues from an injury standpoint as well to the players. So their questions are not all answered right now, especially as to how this might impact the NFL schedule as well, with recruiting players, hosting the combine, which would typically be in the spring, the draft. There's still a lot of questions that unfortunately I don't have the answers to, and neither do either of the leagues.
What are the financial consequences of not having a fall football season?
It's major. I mean, it's major even at the NFL level, especially in Green Bay, because Green Bay is so much like a college town in that there's really nothing besides the football team. So the financial implications are huge because the university uses that money from generated from a big sport such as football to finance other things at the university, other sports that aren't big revenue sports, like more Olympic sports. So to not have that flow of cash coming in because of the football season, it's devastating. But you know, we've seen this happen in so many industries around the country. It's going to be devastating.
Football players have been speaking up, though, about how they feel about either a season not going on or a season going on in another league. So what are you hearing?
There seems to be two camps. We saw the Big Ten and the Pac-12 players from both of those leagues, not all of them, put out a statement online saying that, you know, kind of almost wanting to unionize in a way and to have certain rights protected. And then we kind of saw other players who maybe weren't in the same camp from other leagues share their posts and support them, but also say, hey, we want to play. However, this is what we'd like protected as well. And kind of the issue with that, it comes down to the NCAA and the fact that the players are amateurs and they can't unionize because they are overseen by the NCAA. And that's why that exists. So we've kind of seen this instance for the Pac-12 and the Big Ten where they would rather uphold that amateur status of their players rather than give them any sort of protections that would be considered to be kind of, it would take away from their amateur status, whether they were given different housing from students or any sort of additional protections.
Well, could it even open the door for them getting stipends or being paid?
Right. And I think you've seen that at the NFL level where they've been able to bargain for certain protections and, like you said, stipends or cash advances from their salaries if they do want to opt out at the NFL level. And the players, the college athletes can't do that because they can't get paid. It's part of the NCAA rules. So it can't happen unless somehow the players separate from the NCAA.
So we know what the Big Ten's decision is. What are the other NCAA conferences doing going forward for the fall?
So they're going full steam ahead right now. The ACC, the Big 12, they are all, and the SEC, those three, the other three Power Five conferences are saying, you know, we're keeping our minds open. If our doctors for some reason say, hey, you know, we should stop, we should pause, we should delay, then we'll follow that advice. However, you would think that they're seeing all the same information that the Pac-12 and the Big Ten are seeing, so why are they making a different decision? It's a good question, but we'll see. It's certainly not set in stone, and we've seen that decisions can be made within days or weeks.
We're talking about the postponing of college football, the return of pro sports with Olivia Reiner from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where Olivia covers the Packers, the Brewers, the Bucks. Taking your questions and your insights, if you were a pro sports athlete, how often would you want to be tested for COVID-19? What would you want to have happen if a player or coach tests positive? Should they be benched, isolated, quarantined? What happens to the team? We're at 800-642-1234. Olivia, let's talk NFL. The league plans to have a regular season, not really a bubble whatsoever, in the what we're seeing out of the NBA. What do players think of this?
They all actually, from what we've been talking to players as they've come back to training camp on the Packers, and they're happy to be back. I think they're looking for some normalcy to take place in their lives right now, and football brings that. There doesn't seem to be much fear. Only one player on the Packers opted out, Devin Funchess, wide receiver that the Packers picked up in free agency in the spring. So he will not be playing for the team, however. Every other Packers player will be. They seem to be pretty happy to be back. you know, we'll see how that goes as the season goes on. Right now, the NFL has been able to keep tests pretty positive tests pretty low, which is
under 1%.
Yeah, it's pretty low. And as you mentioned, sort of at the top of the show, they're going to continue doing daily testing throughout training camp. It was supposed to end after just 2 weeks. And then they would switch to every other day. But now they are going through training camp testing every day. And we'll see. I wouldn't be surprised if they decided to do that through the regular season as well.
Okay, so what does this regular season then look like? Because it's going to be far from regular.
It's not. Yeah, right. An irregular season,
yeah.
I suppose. It is going to look pretty similar, I suppose, for the players, except for maybe the fact that fans aren't going to be in the stadium in many cases. That hasn't been an NFL-wide mandate. However, some teams like the Packers have said, okay, for the first two home games at Lambeau, there will be no fans in the stadium, and we will adjust going forward. Teams like the Dallas Cowboys have said, no, I think, you know, we're gonna have fans. We're just going to distance them, and there will be tailgates. We're going to distance them. So different teams are saying different things. But the game itself should be pretty similar, I would think.
So what happens if there is a positive test on a team, you know, headed into a game? How does the NFL handle this?
So the NFL has created a different IR designation if a player either contracts coronavirus or they come into contact with somebody who tested positive, and that is the COVID IR list. And a player can be put on that list. They will not count against the roster. And then a team can bring up a player from the practice squad. They can sign a player off the street. Granted, if they would need to pass coronavirus testing in order to be signed. So there's some flexibility. And right now there's actually 5 players on that list for the Packers. But yeah, it's not going to be easy, because what if an entire position group somehow ends up on the list? How do you go into a game with an entire offensive line on the COVID IR list? And of course, these are all the worst possible scenarios.
Well, that could be really dangerous too for players who have never played with each other or have had little time with a team.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's two different enemies to this. There are two different challenges this season. It's the actual game of football itself and all of the challenges that brings. And you know, every year, every season up until this point, we've seen how challenging it is to play this game and to be good at this game. And then there's also the challenge of the virus. It's a whole separate game that these teams have to deal with, that the coaches have to worry about. How far are the chairs distanced in their meeting rooms? Are they following all the proper regulations? Are players not, you know, going out off and going out when they're not supposed to be? They're supposed to be home and distancing. It is two different games, and they're kind of being played at all times during the day this season.
We're looking at the long-term impacts of the pandemic on the sports world with Olivia Reiner of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. When it comes to the NFL, what are your thoughts on players if they opt out of the upcoming season? How do you feel about players receiving a stipend for games they would have played? Have you been following your favorite players during off-season? How are they expressing themselves? Are they wearing masks? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Olivia Reiner on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The return of sports is underway. The NBA is in a bubble. The NFL is training camps in a more loosely controlled environment with daily testing. But the Big Ten football season is canceled, and college sports programs are facing big dollar consequences that we'll be watching for. What are you watching for as teams try to keep infections in check? What questions do you have about NBA rules to keep players safe? How do you feel about the 2020 NBA bubble? Still time to join in, 800-642-1234. We have sports multimedia reporter Olivia Reiner from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as our guide. Olivia, before we move on from the NFL, what fines or penalties are there for players who do not follow the rules?
There are penalties and rules, especially for when they are not in the facility. When they're in the facility, they're being surrounded by their teammates and their coaches, and they're able to perhaps enforce the rules, distancing rules, wearing a mask, all of that a little bit easier. However, when players go home, there's nowhere, no one to enforce those rules but themselves. Perhaps if they live with other players, they can hold each other accountable. However, there are fines in place that the NFL has that if they're doing specific things that are deemed reckless behavior by the league, they can be penalized if they're caught doing so. That would include eating out at a restaurant indoors or going to a bar, or usually it depends on how many people are present in a place and if it's indoors. So they're discouraged from doing that. Certain teams, the Packers are not one of these teams, are staying in hotels for training camp to try to create.
I saw the Saints. The Saints took over a French Quarter hotel.
Yeah, yeah. And the Seattle Seahawks are doing something similar as well. And I believe the Dallas Cowboys are too. Interestingly enough, yesterday, a Seahawks player was caught bringing a woman into the team hotel, and he has since been cut from the team. Mm. So they're not allowed to have any guests. And that rule, those rules will apply when the Packers are on the road playing games during the regular season. So there are rules like that, that only no visiting members are allowed in the team hotel. So there are a substantial list of rules to try and keep these players safe.
Let's move on to the NBA in its bubble in Orlando. What are you seeing there?
Well, we're seeing that things have been really successful so far down in the bubble in Disney World. There haven't been any positive tests inside of the bubble, which is great news. That's the whole point of the bubble is to keep the virus out and to keep players and coaches and everyone that's working down there negative and free from the virus. An interesting wrinkle now that is being thrown into this is that they're going to start allowing family members and close friends into the bubble. I don't know exactly what constitutes a close friend. There must be some threshold to be considered a close friend. It can't be someone you've never met or maybe you only know virtually. But they're going to start being allowed to come into the bubble, which is great news for the players who have been alone and only with their teammates this entire time. I'm sure they're looking forward to having family members. However, now those people are going to have to comply by all the rules that the players have been following. So more people, just a little bit more of a risk if people aren't following rules, but hopefully they will and they're able to pull off these playoffs without a hitch.
We're talking about how the NBA is keeping players safe during the season. Our guide is Olivia Reiner, a sports multimedia reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's taking us through the sports. You can join in on what you think, what you're seeing about the sports leagues and their decisions, how they keep the players and coaches safe. We're at 800-642-1234. So, Olivia, the playoffs get underway Monday. Can we talk about sports now, like what you're seeing on the court?
Right? There's sports happening. It's crazy.
What are you seeing?
Yeah, so the Bucks are in the playoffs. They've been playoff. They when they came into the bubble, they were going to the playoffs. That was already set. They had the best record in the Eastern Conference. At that point, they were just playing for seeding in these 8 seeding games that the entire NBA played before starting the playoffs next week. The Bucks only needed to win 2 games in order to secure the top seed in the Eastern Conference. They did that. And once they did that, everything else was kind of meaningless. And we kind of saw that for the Bucks. They didn't win a whole lot of games in the bubble. However, a lot of those games didn't matter so much. The most important part, and head coach Mike Budenholzer alluded to this yesterday, is that the team is coming into the playoffs healthy. So everyone should be available for the playoffs starting on Monday. And not all teams can say that. So the Bucks will play against the Orlando Magic on Monday in the first round of the playoffs. And it should be a good game.
Series. Giannis got caught headbutting and was suspended for a game. What happened there?
I think his passion may have gone a little overboard. I think he headbutted a player on the Washington Wizards pretty early in the game the other day and was issued a one-game suspension. After the game, his teammates, and he kind of alluded to perhaps some cheap shots building up and some frustration at the fact that refs weren't calling things. So it boiled over. It was pretty unnecessary considering the stakes of the game were pretty low. Washington isn't a very good team. So he was suspended for a game. He was suspended for the last game of the seeding round. However, he will be available to play on Monday.
All right. So what are you looking for as they take on the Magic? How does the Magic look?
They're okay. I think that this should be easy for the Bucks. I think it would be a major upset if the Magic were able to pull off any wins against the Bucks. We just need to keep seeing the same from their star players, from Giannis, from Eric Bledsoe, from Chris Middleton, and some support off the bench, which, you know, those bench players have also been really good. And seeing, you know, that this is a great team that the Bucks have that defensively as well. Are they able to up their defensive firepower as well, not just in the paint, which I think they're pretty good at regularly, but also at the arc as well, defending three-point shots too. So I think that'll be a big key for them heading into the playoffs, not just in this series against the Magic, but going forward as well.
Olivia, is the fan attraction there? Is the momentum there, that energy we would get in the playoffs, is that missing?
You know, I guess we'll find out. I think it's probably going to be more of the same as what we saw in the seeding games. But it does seem like it's a good environment. They're pumping in some music. It's not very crowd noise heavy, but the intensity has been pretty high, and the fans on the digital screens are in full force. They're able to fans are able to participate and call in, kind of like video call in, and show their support for their teams, depending on who the home team is. So, they're trying. They're certainly trying to create an environment that's competitive. But these games have really been entertaining, and it's good to know that the players are all healthy, too, up until this point.
Well, let's squeeze in here the Brewers and how they're doing this season. A few Major League Baseball teams have struggled with outbreaks, canceled games. How are the Brewers doing?
The Brewers have been able to stay mostly healthy, which is really great, considering that their close by rival in the Cardinals suffered a pretty bad outbreak, and they were supposed to play in Milwaukee, and they ended up getting stuck in the hotel in Milwaukee because they had so many players and coaches test positive, and they couldn't play against the Brewers. They missed the entire Brewers series, so they were stuck in the hotel until they were allowed to leave. So the Brewers missed a few games. They've been struggling this season. It hasn't been a super hot one. They lost their first game of four against the Cubs down in Chicago last night, and they play again tonight at 7:15. So we'll see how that goes. But, you know, I think if they can get through the season, that will be a positive in and of itself.
Olivia, thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
Olivia Reiner is a sports multimedia reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers Packers, Brewers, and Bucks. Just ahead, we invite you to share your programming ideas with us as we look ahead to the November general election. It's a caller only on politics and government. What you'd like to discuss leading up to the general election, bring your ideas, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.